Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Nearly 9 in 10 pharmacies have reported being the victims of crime, according to their representative organisation, the Irish Pharmaceutical Union. There was a survey done of around 230 pharmacies around the country, and 89% of them said they were victims of crime. The types of crime, most of them, 96%, I think, are shoplifting, have faced shoplifting. There was another 72% experienced crime involving a knife, 28% with syringes, and even guns at 11%. Áine McGrory, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And thanks for chatting to us. This all sounds like familiar territory to you.
Yeah, you've described everything there. I can check a box on. Over the past 10 years, I have had knife crime. I've had people threatening me with infected syringes. I've had people just jumping over the counter. There's also just verbal abuse as well, or threats in pharmacy. Shoplifting is something that occurs on a daily basis. So all of that, like you said, yeah, very familiar.
So I suppose let's start with the shoplifting. You say it happens on a daily basis. What kind of stuff are people going after?
Anything that's not attached, anything that's of any sort of value. Premium supplements and vitamins will be taken. Your fake tan, fragrances, anything that can be traded or sold.
And how brazen are you talking about? I mean, are people skilled in removing stuff, or is it simply run in, grab and run out again?
Yeah, and I mean, we're brazen enough that, like, a lot of these people, I would know their names and where they live, and they would be repeat offenders. So it's gone to the stage now where I operate a mag lock system where I buzz people in and out of the pharmacy because I cannot afford to get in security. And even at that, if we did get security in, I don't think it would act as much of a deterrent.
I mean, I'll come back to you for some of the details on that, but you say you've experienced all of the above. I mentioned syringes, knife and gun crime, even guns. Have you experienced that?
The first time I was held up with a gun at the age of 19 in South Circular Road. That was my first experience of serious crime in pharmacy. I was a pharmacy student at the time. We were working in a late night pharmacy on a busy main street, and a man came in, held a gun up and took all the takings in the till and medicines that had street value left.
What kind of medicines are you talking about there? Benzodiazepines, opioids, those kind of things?
Benzodiazepines, opioids, all of the above, yeah.
At the age of 19, you were still a student. Did it cause you to question whether or not you were going to go ahead and become a pharmacist at all?
No, it didn't. It was definitely an experience. I have to say, though, I was not the person that had to deal with that person who was holding a gun up. It was the pharmacist they were the only one who had access to the controlled drugs. Unfortunately, that pharmacist left the community, so it definitely impacted her. I can't say, perhaps if I was with the person who had a gun to their head, maybe that would have deterred me, but it's now become so part and parcel of community pharmacy. I've done interviews where people have said to me, listen, you are going to be held up in this pharmacy, so if you don't, if you can't accept that, then this job isn't for you.
They know that.
Yeah, they know in advance that you're going to be a victim of crime in the pharmacy. And they can put in as many deterrents as they want, but it doesn't seem to be effective.
And you've come to expect this, have you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's something, I mean, I work in a pharmacy. Shoplifting is budgeted at the moment so you would expect about 15% shrinkage from shoplifting alone. So that's just what they would say, victimless crime. But it's not, because it's very disheartening for you. You're servicing a community and people are taking advantage of you. And there doesn't seem to be supports in place or anything that can be done to prevent it from happening.
Right. There's obviously, you know, whatever about the shoplifting hitting, you know, about 15% potentially of your takings in any given year. There's the frustration on your part as well, which, but you rank that much lower than the impact of obviously somebody sticking up the pharmacy. And yet you seem to price that in to the kind of day-to-day experience as well. So when you're buzzing somebody through the door or when somebody comes through the door, I mean, is there a level of kind of hypervigilance there that this could go anyway?
Yes, there is. But as I said, I mean, a lot of the time we know who is the people are to keep an eye out for because they're, you know, repeat offenders. But a lot of the time, though,
repeat offenders for shoplifting or stick-ups?
Abusive behaviour, not always stick-ups.
Okay.
But, you know, we still have a duty of care and we have to let people in. But the it's just deterrence tactics with what I can afford in the pharmacy at the minute is a maglock system. The resources are limited in what we can do. The legislation doesn't really protect us. The Garda don't have the bandwidth for it. We're kind of, it's just, as you said, it's something to be expected and something that we just have to deal with on a daily basis. But
so could you put a figure on the number of times, you know, you've been robbed with either counter jumping or syringes or knives or demands for money from the till in your career? Yeah.
In my career, about 5 times.
And have you ever questioned?
If you're talking about serious
things. Yeah. Have you ever questioned whether or not you were going to continue as a pharmacist? Or there may be people out there listening thinking, why did you continue working as a pharmacist?
Because those people that are doing that are that's a great question. And the want to service the community is higher. There are people who will be deterred by that, but I mean, crime is going up in this country in every sector. Anything that you're going to do that is going to be public-facing, you're going to be at risk of these kind of situations. And pharmacy is at a slightly higher risk because, you know, it tends to be kind of more female and a younger team members. And we also have kind of the medicine side of things that makes it more... That's the kind of stuff that people want to steal.
Sure. You're obliged to stock certain medicines if you want a HSE contract, aren't you?
I mean, the thing is, like, yes, absolutely. But also, we are also obliged to service the public. Like I said, the maglock itself is more of a deterrent, but there's limits to, you know, I've had as you say, like, repeat offenders, and they are still allowed to come back in, and we still have to provide care for them if they need it. That's a tough one for me.
As in people who have previously come in and been abusive or robbed from your shop, and you know where they are, and have you reported them to the Gardaí previously, or would you be reluctant to do that because they can keep coming back to the shop?
I stopped reporting to the Gardaí. I used to report to the Gardaí, but I mean the Gardaí just don't have the bandwidth for it. They can't get out fast enough, and they're under resourced. Mm. So there's only so many times you're gonna keep seeking help like that before it's a moot point. There's no point in doing that, because then what ends up happening is they come later down the line or a day later, and the incident has already passed.
Right.
So you are very much left on your own.
And that survey I referenced at the top that was done by your representative organisation, the IPU, says that 31% of pharmacies aren't even reporting crimes at all. 69% of crimes, they say, were reported to Gardaí, but only 22% of the respondents felt their case was dealt with, quote, very effectively or effectively. They were obviously the survey choices. And, they have grown frustrated with the responses to this type of crime. Stay with us there for a second, Áine. Bláthain, this sounds like familiar territory to you too, does it?
I should put you were something.
All right. Hi, Bláthain. No, Bláthain's. Bláthain. Deirdre, can you hear me there? All right, we'll come back. We'll come back to you though, Anya, on this.
Look, you're stuck with me, Paula. I can keep going.
Yeah, no, that's no problem. We have them on the other line, but obviously, look, it's a busy job, and I'm conscious I'm taking up, you know, your time
sure.
as well. But I mean, it is great to get a first hand insight.
Into what the findings are.
You mentioned there, you know, the security measures you have to take. I mean, when you're entrusted with opioids or benzodiazepines by the HSE as part of your contract, is there a certain level of security you have to provide around that? And what is that?
There is guidance on security and adequate staffing, and there's only so much that we can do with that. I mean, I'm personally as an independent pharmacy owner. The pharmacist has to keep full responsibility of the controlled substances or the desirable substances. Like I said, we do what we can, but I mean, the sector is grossly underfunded at the moment. We are under-resourced. January, we're taking a further hit. So, guidance and things is very important, and we follow it as best we can. And I'm doing the best I can. Certainly my staff, I mean, what we really do is the training. I do a lot of training with my staff about how to deal with the inevitability that is crime in pharmacy.
And what do you tell them?
The procedures.
Yeah, look, what is the training there? And is it kind of...
The training there is to maintain your personal safety at all costs. That you allow that person to take whatever they want. You step back. If there's a weapon involved, you call the guard. I mean, call the guards if you can, but you comply and you just have to allow it. I don't want any heroes in the pharmacy. It's not worth anyone's safety. And you know, that's the best that we can do is that we try and make it as least traumatic an experience as possible.
All right.
Yeah.
If you can bear with us.
I've been in positions where I've had people hold me up with knives and they've been in a state of complete emotional dysregulation. And then they have returned and apologized profusely to me and my staff. And we're very gracious about that because you're asking about being deterred from pharmacy. I guess no, because these people committing these crimes as well have also been let down massively by, their circumstances. So people doing this, they don't do it because they want to, because it's fun for them. A lot of this is to fund, people who use drugs needing to get access to finances or trading something off. So, you know, it is a systemic issue. There's also legislation like the Protection of Retail Workers Act needs to be passed quickly. There's a Public Orders Act that would allow for exclusion of people who are repeat offenders in the shop. And there's lots of things that can be done, and I'd love to see it done. It's definitely, I would say, probably more prevalent. The violent crime and prevalence is higher in pharmacy because of the nature of the drugs that we supply.
All right. As you say, you're particularly in the firing line because people who are in the full throes of addiction may seek out the drugs that you have on the premises. But what you're saying there and some of the remedies that aren't across the line yet would be familiar, I'm sure, to plenty of retail staff. If they want to relate their experiences, we're on 0874848888 for WhatsApps on that. Just bear with us for a second, Anya. Blaheen, you've been listening to Anya there. I mean, this all sounds like familiar territory to you too, does it?
Yes, we have been the victims of violent crime twice in the last year. Our pharmacy was attacked, I'll call it, one day. 2 days later, another man came back in, performed the same thing all over again and robbed us again. And there is very little you can do when you've got a shop with an open door and somebody comes in with a hoodie and a knife and says, I want money and drugs. And really, the problem is you have to protect your staff. And a lot of the staff in pharmacies are young girls, are young people, and it's very frightening for them, very frightening. And you have the responsibility to protect them and look after them, which is quite onerous. You know, I mean, if anything happened to your staff, I think it wouldn't be worth your job or your life.
And I'm conscious.
And that's a huge responsibility to have.
Sure.
We had somebody who came in.
Yeah, no, that's all. I was just going to ask you. Sorry,
go. The shop, put on a balaclava and come in. We have security cameras, we have locks on the door, we have panic buttons, but the deed is done before anybody can be there. Plus, there's a lack of Gardaí on the beat around the town where I'm working. Though having said that, the guards were great when they came. And they came quite quickly because there was another robbery in the area the day it happened here.
And can I ask you, I know you've said, you know, the deed and you've been subject to two of these kind of holdups in the past year, but for somebody, and there are loads of people out there who go to work every day, they will never experience a stick up. They will never have a knife produced in the course of providing a service to the public. There are many, of course, who have had this experience, unfortunately. But can you tell us how one of the incidents unfolded and give us an insight into, you know, how you're feeling as all of this is happening?
Well, I feel worried that somebody's going to attack my staff. You know, you're just standing in the shop doing your own business. There might be an elderly person sitting waiting for their tablets, and they're vulnerable as well. What happened to us was somebody just opened the door with the hoodie, black tracksuit, black hoodie. You couldn't see their face. The cameras could pick out a figure, but not any details. And they just stand there and take out a knife and say, open your till, and they take all the money out of the till. That's not as lucrative as it used to be now, because most people pay with taps and cards, so cash isn't as big a draw. And then they know what they want. They want benzodiazepines, they want fentanyl, they want Lyrica, they want morphine. They know they're in the safe, and they go with you in while you empty the safe, and you're there saying, what do you want?
And you're in there opening the safe, and somebody is standing behind you brandishing a knife in a threatening way. I mean, are they always in a state of agitation when this is going on?
They are, usually, yes. But you can't afford to take the risk to challenge them or to attack them. All you want to do is get them out of there as quickly as possible and hope that nobody's injured.
And how are you managing to remain calm and open the door of the safe while somebody is there armed with a weapon threatening you?
I think it's your adrenaline just kicks in and you're scared, but you just have to do it. The alternative is worse, probably, because the quicker you give it to them, the quicker they'll go. And you don't want to antagonise them. I mean, we're trained to keep calm. You're trained how to deal with emergencies. Like if you had to do CPR for somebody who collapsed in the pharmacy, it's the same feeling. Okay, just do it. Take a deep breath and say, you've been trained how to deal with this. Just get over it.
But
doesn't make it any easier.
No, but I mean, if somebody collapses...
It's very scary for all the staff.
If you're somebody and collapses and you're administering CPR, that's one thing. You're helping someone. They leave, the ambulance takes them away. You have a sense that, you have helped somebody, and whatever the outcome, it's not your fault. When somebody comes in to your business, your private space, and robs from you, no matter how many practical protocols you have in place, there must be a massive sense of violation.
Oh, there is. There is. But the only reason I'm comparing it to the CPR is that is how you cope with it. Your reactions are the same in an emergency situation, and you sort of go into autopilot and hope that it'll go away as quickly as possible.
And how long does it stay with you then afterwards? You know, the heightened sense of alert, the stress, the trauma that's brought on by being robbed.
I don't know. It's sort of, I suppose for at least a month afterwards, every time the door opens, you're wary. For a while afterwards, we said we locked the door. And then, that's bad for business. Your normal customers can't get in. You're running up and down to open the door every time you see a customer. Mm. Just have to get on with
your normal life.
But what about your mood at home? You know, I mean, how are you around going about your daily business? I mean, what's the length of your tether when it comes to, you know, your own mood? Do you notice a shift after you've had an incident like that? Are you a bit less patient? You know, can you discern the impact on your day-to-day life?
You're a bit shaken, all right. And maybe when you get out of the shop and get around to your normal life, you sort of try and forget about it and just get on with whatever you do normally. But it's just part of work, part of what happens. It's not nice, and it's, you know, financially quite damaging. I mean, sometimes when I'm in bed at night, I'd say, well, maybe should we have brought them into the safe, locked them into the room, send everybody out the other door? And then I just thought, if I did that, they'd probably wreck the shop, you know, because we have quite a few little entrances and exits. But I just said, the easiest thing to do is give them what they want and let them go. If I locked them in, they could wreck the place completely.
And would you have, you know,
come back again?
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. Yeah, I mean, the prospect of them coming back, if somebody comes in masked and armed with a knife, you wouldn't know them if they came back in again.
No. You just have to get on with it. I think the fact that maybe 99% of your customers and the people who come in are genuine and need help and get it, we're used to helping people. So we tend not to be suspicious. We tend to try and do our best to help people. Mm. So when you're violated like that, it makes it even worse.
Yeah, I mean, there's people starting pharmacy courses all over the country. This is a warning from the future, is it? This is what they have in store for them.
Probably. But, you know, it's probably just a result of all the drug taking that's a lot more tolerated in society than it used to be.
Right.
As well.
It's got worse in your experience. Yeah. Deirdre, you've been listening to Áine and Bláthnaid there as well.
I have.
It all rings a bell, does it?
Well, thank God we haven't been, you know, we have had no knife attacks or anything like that. But I do find, in general, the level of aggression has definitely increased. And we have been threatened, I suppose, in the shop, and one of my staff has been shouted at in the street. And
outside, just when they were going about their daily business.
She was going about her daily business. They recognised her from the shop and shouted at her. And it is much more common than it used to be. And it's just difficult to deal with. It's really, now, as Áine said, it's 1% or less of our patience. However, when it does happen, it's not a bit pleasant, and it's hard to deal with.
And got
and
worse since when, Deirdre?
I personally feel, I don't know why that is. I feel that maybe people weren't dealing in a mannerly way with people, and they just seem to take it out on people working in the general public, with the general public. I have no scientific data to cover that up, but
that's your sense.
But my feeling is, yeah, that in general, it is since then. And, you know, as Áine said, you know, I don't know how many times we've been just robbed, as in pickpocket, not with the knife, but in 30 years as a community pharmacist, and I don't know how many times I've been robbed. There hasn't been one conviction.
Yeah, I wouldn't even worry about robbery now. I'm just worried about knife attacks.
I know.
And the funny thing is, people who attack you with a knife.
Yeah, so sorry, Bláthnaid, you were saying that there are... Deirdre, I'll come back to you in a second. Bláthnaid, yeah?
Oh, sorry. The people that attack you with the knife aren't really in their right minds. They're not normal. They're on drugs. They're hyper. They're sweating. They're nervous as well. I mean, I don't think they mean to be aggressive. It's the addiction that's driving them to it, which is even sadder, because it's sort of the result of a bigger problem of drug addiction.
And Deirdre, the aggression you experienced, I know you were saying it's not, you know, as a result of armed robbery. What are they being aggressive about? Is it the speed of service in dispensing, you know, prescriptions? What is it?
The speed of service. It can be the speed of service. It can be something not being allowed on their medical card or their LPI card or their DPS card. and they just, and I know people who come into us in general are unwell, and I know we get them probably at their worst. We know all that. We're used to dealing with that. But in general, people can just lose the head if you say, I'm sorry, these vitamins aren't allowed on the medical card, you have to buy them. You can just get eruptions. It's something we didn't have to deal with before, is my experience. And we've had products thrown across the counter at us, you know, saying, I'm not taking it if you expect me to pay. Stuff like that, in general, it's just a higher level of aggression.
And the figure there, and I don't know, is Áine still there? Áine, the figure that's been given in this Irish Pharmaceutical Union survey for the costs of security, an average of about $5,500 a year on security, and even some people hiring professional firms. I mean, do you have a ballpark figure on the annual bill for your security?
I don't have. I had to install a maglock system, which is a couple of thousand for me. For me to get in any sort of full-time security, you're talking another salary. And I just simply don't have the capital at the minute to do that. Pharmacies are still operating loss making services, so we can't, you know, there's the budget's just not there. So it's a tough one. Like I said, we just have to have safe protocols in place and do as much that we can with the resources that we have available.
And who provides this training? Like, is there a standard hostile environment training that can be rolled out centrally to people who are going to work in pharmacies, or is it something you have to do and train staff in-house?
Yeah, no, I would do it myself in-house, which, I mean, I would base it off of guidance and personal experience, and we would develop an operating procedure for that the staff would read, and then we would trial. Even at some stages, we've done dummy runs of being held up and explain what to be done. There's been circumstances where we've had incidents and we've gone through the CCTV and discussed what we could have done differently the next time. So preparation is really what we have.
Right, but I'm conscious, you mentioned at the beginning, you know people who are coming in and shoplifting, and you know where they live, and you have them on CCTV, and even at that, you don't always feel that it would be productive to follow up and report to Gardaí. I mean, do you challenge them the next time they come in? Is there any recourse you have, even informally, to get stuff back?
I give them. I've had to reach out usually to a family member and request the stock be returned, or I just sometimes it gets returned, sometimes it doesn't. But I mean, it's nearly like an inconvenience at this stage for them to have to come back down and give the stock back. There's no fear of consequence for this kind of thing, and. That in itself is part of the issue as well.
Okay. Well, we did ask An Garda Síochána for a response to what's raised in the IPU survey. We're still awaiting a response on that.
Could I say one more thing? I do have to go because I'm...
Sure, I understand you're under time pressure there. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so look, what I just wanted to get across, the pharmacists, this is a global issue. Pharmacists around the world are facing criminality and violence. When we're trying to provide healthcare for the vulnerable, and we stand in solidarity with everyone, especially our colleagues in Gaza undergoing a genocide and famine. Thank you for your time. This is a really important issue, and I do have to hop off because my lunch break is over.
Okay.
Which I am very...
All right. Well,
luxury,
look, you've been...
to have, but do please keep talking about it. It's definitely something that needs to be addressed. It's a systemic issue. On Garda Síochána are under resourced. Pharmacies are under resourced. It's not from lack of want. You know, we want things to be better, and we want pharmacy to be a more desirable career choice for people.
Okay.
And we're just working with what we've got at the moment.
All right. Well,
thank you so much.
You packed it in. You packed it in on the lunch break. Thanks very much, Áine. Deirdre, do you want to add to that, just in terms of the security and who does the kind of safety training? You know, what are you missing there?
Well, we've had the guards come down and do some safety training with us, but like Áine says, we just can't afford security. I mean, there's not enough money in a community pharmacist to employ security. There just isn't. So we can't afford another member of staff. It's as simple as that. And you know, it's really difficult. And as she said, you know, I know people who've robbed from us. I know where they live. We have their addresses, and I haven't got the stock back. So, you know, every year there is a loss on my accounts, and there's about maybe 10% is gone, and I don't. It's probably lifted.
Okay, Bláthnaid, do you want to give us a last word?
No, I will just heartily agree with everything that the other two have said. And particularly if you're in a small farm, there's no way you're going to get security because you just couldn't possibly afford it.
All right.
So, you know, we'll just live in hope.
Okay, Bláthnaid, Deirdre and Áine before that. Thanks very much. We'll take a quick break. We're back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Now, we heard from pharmacists on their experiences before the break. We're moving to another area of healthcare now. How are you, Ferdia?
How are you doing, Colin?
How's it going? You you were in Dublin, you moved to Wexford.
Moved home.
About 2 years ago, was it?
Yeah, but actually the anniversary should be only a week or two away, funnily enough.
And in all the time you've been in Wexford, not a chance of getting to a GP.
Yeah, and not for the lack of trying, Colm. I remember toward the start of when we got back, I went into the primary care centre here in the town, and they gave me a list of every single GP kind of within the county it was. And I sort of got out Google Maps and I figured out which ones were within, say, half an hour. And I called every single one of them and not a one was taking in new patients. And the initial thing that surprised me was that most of them don't even operate a waiting list because they sort of profess there's no point. The day they need a new patient, they just wait for the phone to call and it will, you know.
So roughly, do you know how many phone calls you made in those early stages when you rang around the list to the primary care? Are you talking dozens?
I would say there was something to the order of 40 GPs on the list, and I've called all of them at least six times over the course of the last 2 years.
So you began with the ones you reckoned were around half an hour away from you, and then how rapidly did it expand to those 45 minutes to an hour away?
I've called every GP in the county of Wexford that I know of, Colm. If I missed them on the list, that was a mistake, not a conscious decision. I stopped at the border. I didn't kind of think, well, I wonder if there's anything in Arklow, because, I mean, at that point, I might as well just stick with Dublin, you know.
And, Camir, what did they tell you when you were ringing around as to why the lists were closing?
Well, a couple of reasons, Colm. The main one I'd say, the one I got the most frequently, was sort of a flavour that as their patients have kids, the patient that had a kid, their parent sort of goes off the list. You know, they pass away and whatever. So just kind of generationally, the practice has kept busy. As I say, some of them just said, look, before we'd even look at the list to call someone, if we needed a new patient, someone would have called and we just take them.
So there's no point in operating a waiting list. It's just an administrative burden when the demand will come to them.
Yeah, and like the people that are on the list are kind of saying, oh, sure, at least I'm on a list now. But they're kind of not, you know, they're in an Excel spreadsheet somewhere, but that's not being fed from, you know.
And you didn't just ring them once. The 40 GPs once at the beginning of the 2 years and then sit back and fold your tent. You kind of started doing it regularly, didn't you?
Yeah, I called them all pretty much as soon as I had the list. It was just an exercise over the course of a few days. And then I left it maybe 2 months and I said, right, let's try again. And I called the majority, probably all of them again. And then I said, well, okay, I'll leave it 4 months and six. And there's kind of only so much rejection a fella can take at a certain point. Right now, I just sort of get little bursts of optimism and I call two or three. And I know by the voice that I've already talked to the person and I hear the same thing. And, you know, all I can do is stick to a GP that I used to live near until, I don't know, the chips come up right when I call.
And you, where you used to live is how far away from you?
It's in South Dublin City. So I suppose that's what, 150 km, call it an hour and a half to 2 hours of a drive, and then an hour and a half, 2 hours back.
Right. So, I mean, generally speaking, and not your specific case, but a visit to a GP could be 60 quid. And then that round trip of 300 kilometres is a hefty whack out of a tank of petrol or diesel as well. You're looking at, you know, over 100 euro to visit a GP before you get a prescription or a referral onwards.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and then obviously whatever they did incurs further costs. And I don't mind a lick of that. But I'd be much happier giving it to a GP here in Wexford where I am, you know?
Right. I mean, you were talking to Padraig Byrne from the Wexford People and relating your tale of woe on this. And one of the things you said is, thankfully, we're relatively healthy. I mean, if you, yourself and your wife, if you weren't, you'd really be shanghaied, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple of stories there, Cullum. So, first of all, I actually did have an incident about a year ago where I really did need a GP. Now, we're on this, you know, the web doctor where you can do it over the phone. And God, if that hasn't saved us, I don't know how many times with little bits and bobs.
But is that, a lot of people have that through private health insurance. Is that where you access the web doctor from?
My employer, actually, that's a perk of the job, one I'm very grateful for, I might add. But look, I got on to them and she kind of said, look, Ferdia, with migraines, I have to be able to have a look at you. You need a brick and mortar GP.
Because there's limits to what they can prescribe on a web doctor. Once it requires a certain type of prescription, oftentimes a remote doctor might say, look, unless you're here in person to fully examine you, we don't know whether we could prescribe what needs to be prescribed.
They're effectively taking a shot in the dark after a certain amount of information that you can only tell them. They can't see it, you know. But like I said that to her. I said, look, to be honest, I haven't gotten one yet. So I'm left with two choices. Either drive up the motorway with a migraine, and surely that endangers everyone else on the road around me, or I go to the emergency room. And she said, well, look, all I can do is send the emergency room a referral, so it'll cost a bit less. But there's literally, I cannot help you from here. And thus, that was that. I had to go up to the hospital. I'm in there for something a GP probably could have helped with, and who knows who's behind me in the queue that could have been one space up the queue, you know?
And as you say, you can't very well. It's not, you know, a migraine, in case anyone has never had one, is not just any kind of a headache. People get visual disturbances. Oh, yeah. You know, they can have a loss of vision in one or both eyes, and it's beyond a headache. It's hardly even in the same bracket of family of headache in terms of intensity of pain. In no condition to be driving in.
100%. And luckily, I'm within walking distance of the hospital, case in point.
So this is where you're left. It's present yourself at A&E or drive to Dublin. But you're not alone in this. And I mean, there are obviously people out there who have this experience as well in other parts of the country as people have moved out of Dublin, which is relatively better served by GPs than other areas of the country, although not in all areas. I think in a recent paper on GP retirements, places like East Clare and East Mayo and Inishowen and Donegal and Westmeath are areas, along with Wexford actually, where GP retirements are meaning that people are not as well served by GPs as elsewhere in the country. I think 132 GPs retired across those areas, according to a survey that was done on that. I mean, did any of the GPs you talked to talk about the situation improving? Did they say that, you know, well, if you hang on a year, we're expecting a few more to be recruited? Or did the primary care centre say, look, we're looking to expand our service here. We're sorry it's bad now, but it could get better in the future.
I tell you, actually, Cullum, one or two of the GPs here in Wexford said exactly that. They said, actually, we're hiring for a new body, so to speak. We should have that role filled by XYZ. Call back and register. We don't operate a waiting list, by the way. I then do that, and lo and behold, it's actually already filled up, even if I call the day I was told to call. That happened twice.
And what does your man in Dublin make of it, your GP, who you thought would be your former GP, who's still your current GP, when you related this level, this tale of woe to him? Is it something that he sees around Dublin as well?
Well, so, I mean, that's kind of the funny bit, Colm. We don't officially acknowledge with the GP that this is even happening, because when we first discovered, we're not going to be able to get someone immediately, we called up, my wife has a recurring prescription, and we said kind of, we need a repeat prescription, but is there any chance you'd send us down to Wexford? And the GP, or it may have been his receptionist, but six of one, said, look, we can only deal with patients who are within our sort of catchment area. We can't send. Right.
So you have to go even to just get a repeat prescription.
You
have to go to Dublin.
A little bit, yeah, it's a little bit funnier than that. It's not so bad in terms of travel, Colm. We said, okay, please send the prescription to our normal pharmacist then, and we will get it there, no problem. My wife then would call the pharmacist that we used to get it from, who would very helpfully forward it to Selsker here in Wexford, where we would then go and pick up the prescription. We've done that once a month since this occurred. Call the GP, have the prescription sent to the same pharmacist we used to go to, and call that pharmacist to forward it on. And I must admit, I was actually listening to your conversation with some of the pharmacists. That person in the middle is getting nothing out of the deal. Like, she doesn't get the money from us going in and purchasing the prescription. And yet she does it every single month. That's the caliber of
which is very decent,
people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the system that they're in. Like, every GP that says no, I'm quite certain if they have a spot, they'd say yes, but they don't, because that's how busy they are, you know?
What ultimately made you talk to the media about this? Because not everybody ventilates their grievances in public, but at this stage, after 2 years, you know, you've clearly had enough of this.
Yeah, so I suppose there's a few bits, Colin. Like, first of all, if the system doesn't change, other Ferdias, as you said yourself a few minutes ago, are just going to be out there with functionally without a GP. And what happens next? Well, they get sick and something awful happens because they don't have a GP. By sort of talking to the likes of yourself, the Independent, you know, at least there's a conversation around it. I also wrote a few letters to TDs. I guess the other side of it, though,
I mean, Ferdia. I mean, look. It'd be fair to say Ferdia's line's gone down. I mean, the point he may or may not be going to arrive at is, you know, nobody is getting any younger. You might as well solve this problem while you still have the wherewithal to solve it. But anyway, we would like to issue an invitation to all the Ferdias around the country who find themselves in a GP black spot, who want to give us an insight into how they're managing in an area where there is no GP. Is it a situation where you're simply going without healthcare or delaying going to a GP because there's an onerous burden of travel on you? Are you returning to where you used to live? Are you presenting yourself at accident and emergency when the predicament you're in has gone beyond the point where it could even be treated in primary care? You can get in touch with us on 51551 by text on that, or 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApp's Liveline at rte.ie. And if you're a GP out there whose list is full, who can give us an insight maybe into why things are the way they are, whether it's retirement from your practice, whether it's an inability to attract people, whether it's people moving abroad, which is potentially a factor where people with medical training decide they're going to move abroad because of the cost of living and everything else, do let us know. 51551 for your texts, 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps. We're back in a sec.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Ciara Conway, how are you doing?
Hi, Colm. Lovely to talk to you.
Good, lovely to talk to you too. You love a lament.
I do. A little bit obsessed, I have to say.
So tell us about your love of lamentation. Where did it come from?
Sure. So I've always been a visual artist, and around 2013, I realised I could sing. I came to that knowledge quite late in my life. So when I was working on a new art project with a group of asylum seekers in Galway, I decided I want that particular project to be about, to involve singing and to involve the voice. And we were exploring as a group what we wanted the theme to be, and the women wanted the work to be about grief. the grief that they had experienced in their own countries and the grief that they were experiencing living in direct provision. So I started researching songs about grief, and that's the first time that I came across the traditional practice of lamentation or keening or cuina, as we call it, and also the role of the Bám Cuaoine. So the work that I ended up creating called Making Visible really drew upon that practice. And ever since then, I've been making work that utilises kind of lament as a form or as a medium. So I can explain a little bit about what I was interested in the lament practices.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what you know, you're working with a group of women, and as you say, you're talking about grief. So what brought you to the traditional, ancient and now uncommon form of cuina that people would have been familiar with in the past that are no longer familiar with?
Yeah, well, it was new for me. So, like, on cuina as a practice, first of all, it's through the Irish language, and it was a practice, a funeric practice that was held usually by 99% of the time it was women that held this ritual, and their job was to lead the community through a public display of grief. And a lot of people, when they think of keening, they often think it's a group of people like just wailing together, but it was actually an oral poetry. It was highly developed. It was an art form. And their role really was to eulogise the person that was deceased, and they would talk about who they were, what they had achieved, you know, who their family were. And they would often criticise the person publicly as well if they had done things that weren't great. But what I was interested in was how to use this tradition in a contemporary context. So we created a series of performances where we gathered as a community and we called out the direct provision system, and a number of laments were performed as well as part of that performance, along with testimonies from the women. So I was really kind of drawing upon that powerful role that the Bám Cuaoine had in the community at the time, which was the power to speak out and also to perform and to hold this space where people could grieve publicly and together.
And where did, because obviously people who are seeking international protection in Ireland are coming from different traditions. I mean, grief is a shared human experience. But what did they make of the Irish experience of An Cuaoine, and how did they find it in any way difficult to get to grips with the form and the language?
Very good question. No, because this is a universal tradition. If you go into nearly any tradition, there are women who were Bám Cuaoinés across the world, whether it was in Greece or in Africa and Arabic countries. It's still practiced in some countries where it's women who practice this rite of grieving or keening. So it wasn't alien to them. And one of the women that was in the group that we worked with, her name was Veronica Nkube. She was an opera singer. And she performed one of our traditional Seanós cuainas, one of our oldest. It's called An Cuaoine. And she kind of connected to that song on a personal level because her own son had been killed in conflict. And she performed the cuaoine that is, it's about a mother grieving over the loss of her child. So that was quite powerful and poignant within the context of that public lamentation that we did in Galway at the time.
And, you know, you're talking about the funerary practice there and the practitioners of it. Did you do a kind of a workshop on it to explore the Irish tradition of it? Because, you know, I have heard in the past that sometimes the element of criticism or satirising the deceased could be offset if An Bán Cuaoine was paid a few quid for her troubles.
I didn't do any workshop. What I did was I read a lot. I read a lot of essays and writings by Angela de Burke. She's written a lot of amazing papers on the topic, and also through a feminist lens, which really interested me. And also Brendan O'Madigan has written about it.
Right.
And so she discusses the performance tactics of the Bán Cuaoine, you know, how she would have appeared dishevelled or be covered in blood, but that these were actual tactics that she utilised so that people would keep away from her while she was criticising the deceased person. It was almost like a way of keeping people away from her. So there was no workshops per se, but the practice itself in Ireland, you know, ended a long time ago in the 18th century. It was really ousted by the church, who saw any kind of public display of emotion or crying as barbaric and savage-like. It was something that they actually banned. So it was a practice that for a while the band Queen has held on to and would have fought the priests on this. And in fact, there are a number of really famous laments or queenas whereby within the verses you see the band Queen telling the priest to literally fuck off themselves.
Right.
So it's a fascinating tradition. And
Just on that kind of tension between, I suppose, you know, the very, what might be termed today, dignified mm-hmm. form of grieving where, you know, there's an orderly queue and there's a handshake and everything else and there's a quiet funerary silence and people wear somber colours, et cetera, as opposed to the older tradition of, which would have involved a lot of more ancient practices that people mm-hmm. might have come to describe as superstitions, like turning mirrors and covering mirrors and that kind of thing. Was there an element to the Queen of an icebreaker where people don't really quite know what to do with themselves at a funeral, and the band Queen provides an element of release? She's breaking a silence. She's, you know, opening it up for people to express themselves. And the more extreme she is, anything relative to that is going to seem, you know, somewhat understated.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. So from what I've learned and read about, the Queen would have gone on for about maybe 2 or 3 days. It would have happened in the house or the home of the deceased, and it would have been a raucous affair. So you would have had the band Queen surrounding the corpse or the body, along with members of the family and other younger women, and she would have been reciting or eulogising, and that would have been quite rhythmic.
We have a wee clip, Ciara. We're just going to give it a play to give listeners a sense of it.
Yeah. Косоля
It's obviously got instrumental accompaniment mm-hmm. and it's neither wild nor raucous, but I mean, what is that tradition bedded in? Where, you know, where is that type of song coming from? What's your own thoughts on that?
So I would say that that's a highly instrumentalized and melodic version of what used to be Queena. So Queena beforehand was an oral poetry. There was no instrumentation with it, and it wasn't ornamental. It was very much like a recitation that had rhythm and it had pace, and it had a motif that would remain central and the same throughout, like a template, but it would change also. It was improvised. So very, very different to what you've heard just there. So right. what we call laments now is quite a musical version of what used to exist before.
And it may, the laments or Queen may not have been on people's radar, but Traitors last night on telly did an activity where people had to, do a mock funeral, and Queen was one of the elements in it, which hasn't been seen at a funeral in a long time, but it was incorporated mm-hmm. into that, I suppose, because it's set in a medieval castle. They're trying to give that sense of old world traditions. Patricia Lysett, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you.
You are Professor of Folklore at UCD.
Yes, retired Professor of Folklore.
Professor of Folklore. So the role of Queena in Irish tradition, where would you put it and how important was it?
Well, I think the conversation you've had so far has wonderfully described it. And we have, as your speaker has said, we have plenty of evidence for it in medieval Ireland and subsequently and attitudes to it. I think it's important to emphasise that, first of all, it was family who lamented. And if family could lament, be they male or female, that was done once the corpse was laid out. In other words, it wasn't done while the person was dying. It wasn't done immediately the person was dead, because they had to allow the soul to make its journey. And it wasn't done until the person was properly laid out and it was available for public attention. And then it was done by members of the family that were able to do it. And we have plenty of accounts of families doing it. A brother down in County Kerry doing it for his brother who had been killed by a fall from a horse, for example. And there are other accounts of it. So it was family to start with. And then we have plenty of accounts as well, many of them from the 17th century, which tells us that really it was almost a question of vanity when hired keeners were brought in to lament as well. Additionally, or indeed maybe they took over the role eventually when people themselves didn't feel able to lament anymore. But the important thing is they wanted the lament, because the lament honoured the dead person. It was addressed to the dead person. It described all how good he was and so on and so forth. And then you could have mock laments which weren't so nice in terms of the person that had died. But they honoured the dead, and through that, they honoured the family. So it was an ongoing tradition, as the honour of the family was very important as well.
And you do get, I suppose, Irish poets who would have, you know, lamented their own situation with the fall of the Irish chieftains system, with the flight of the earls after the Battle of Kinsale, lamenting their own plight in satirical form about the new arrivals and the new landowners. So, I mean, do they occupy two sides of the one coin, the praise and the lament, and I suppose the dangerous weapon of satire? Are they kind of part... two sides of the coin of the one canon of work?
Well, you did have the literary poets who wrote about that, their laments. They lamented, as you say, these topics you have dealt with. They lamented the decline of the Irish language and so on. So the lament was there, the satire was there. And then you had the improvised lament, which the family and the keening women did. It was improvised in the sense that they addressed the person before them, but the topics were traditional. They knew the topics. They knew what basically they were going to say when they came to the house. They just had to make sure that it referred to the person who was dead before them. Now, where you had a family member, for example, like a wife lamenting her husband, a member of the family, there's one lovely lament that Sean O'Sullivan has shown in this, his book, Irish Wake Amusements, for example, where he was a ploughman. And she talks about, and she treasures his skill as a ploughman. So that was a family member absolutely acquainted with her husband's skills and so on. And that was the one that she liked very much and that she wanted remembered, because it was a skill. He was a skilled ploughman. And that was no mean skill in rural Ireland well into the 20th century, to be able to plough a good furrow, a straight furrow. So she made sure that he would be remembered in his family and locally as a skilled ploughman. So there were many ways you could use the lament for a family member, or if you were displeased with somebody, you could do a mock lament, do it in the traditional form of the lament. And when that sort of lament started, you would imagine that it was going to be very praiseworthy. But somebody could say, well, you know, you were rather mean. Right. You made the butter, but you hid it away. and so on and so forth. And then she would say, a father go maroon, you know, my sweetheart, my love, and so on.
Is there any record, and I appreciate this may not be the case, but did anyone crash a funeral and give a satirical lament spontaneously off the cuff in order to make their feelings known about the deceased? Well, somebody who wasn't related nor indeed invited?
Well, the ones I one or two I'd be familiar with, it was actually the wife who was doing it. And I have to say, she was rather brilliant at it. The way she could do it, she would praise the husband and then say, well, of course, you were one for the cows and you would make the butter, but you hid it away in the press and I couldn't get it, and so on and so forth. So in many ways, it's almost funny, you know, but it was the skill with which it was done which showed that she was a poet and that she could use the traditional form of the lament to actually undermine the deceased. And then maybe even to make the drama even more interesting, you might find a sister of the dead person or somebody else come back and answer the wife, you know. So you had the wife giving the lament, which wasn't very nice, and then you had the sister coming back contradicting her, which actually in many ways made the situation worse, you know. So this drama was fantastic, and it shows the skill of the people who were involved in it, people you probably wouldn't expect to be able to do it. And there they come forward, and using the rhythm and the topics and the motifs of the traditional lament, actually criticize somebody fundamentally, somebody who was mean and abusive in life, sort of thing, you know, and in their opinion, not deserving of being praised in death.
Okay, a tradition kept alive today through dueling rap artists, maybe somewhere in the Detroit area, as well as, you know, obviously being part of the rich Irish tradition. Patricia Lysett, former professor, retired professor of folklore at UCD, thanks very much for talking to that. And Ciara Conway, thanks very much for giving us the insight of your work with Cuíne for the modern era, working with also people who are seeking direct provision and their insights into that. It's been a pleasure talking to you both.